December 7th, 1949. I'm from a small town in northern Illinois called Hampshire. In the late 1960s, Hampshire had a population of about 1,000 people, and it is a village principally concerned, at that time at least, with the dairy industry. It's about 45 miles northwest of Chicago. I grew up on a dairy farm, and my early schooling was all within the public school system in Hampshire, including Hampshire Elementary School, Hampshire Junior High School, and Hampshire High School. I graduated from Hampshire High School in 1967 in what was then the largest graduating class from that school, which was 49 students. Approximately half of us were pre-college, as opposed to vocational in the education that we received. While at Hampshire, the one faculty member who influenced me the most was a man named William Schmidt. Bill Schmidt had received his master's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison back either in the late 40s or early 50s. I had Bill Schmidt as a teacher for all 4 years of high school for such courses as world history, American history, civics, and current issues. Schmidt was a fairly progressive or liberal Democrat, which was about as rare in Hampshire as anything. Democrats in Kane County, Illinois, were few in number and probably were equated with socialist and communist in the public's mindset. Like many members of my family and people in Hampshire, I was raised as a Republican and maintained this status all the way through high school, despite Bill Schmidt's influence. In my high school yearbook, however, he wrote that he expected me to be a liberal history teacher. Because Bill Schmidt went to Wisconsin, he encouraged me to, at some point in my life, to attend that university rather than my home state university, which would have been the University of Illinois. When I graduated from high school, I was pretty undecided as to what I wanted to do, so I went ahead and enrolled in a junior college in Elgin, Illinois, called Elgin Junior College. There I took several English and drama courses under a professor named Terry Domsky. Although Terry Domsky had gone to Indiana for his graduate degree, he knew graduate students in English at Wisconsin, and with him I visited the Madison campus, I believe in the summer of 1968, if not earlier, and met some graduate students in English. By that time, I had decided to major in English as opposed to history, and once I visited Madison, I immediately fell in love with the environment there. This, of course, was also the heyday of the student movement in the late 60s, and while at Elgin College, I became politicized and developed a strong opposition to the Vietnam War, and true to Bill Schmidt's prediction, turned quite liberal politically. So I was very excited about the possibility of attending Wisconsin, where it seemed to me the student movement was quite active. I applied to Wisconsin as well as several other universities and was delighted when I was accepted to Wisconsin. My great dilemma was going to be how to finance any education. I was working part-time while at Elgin College at a gasoline station pumping gas, but what I could save from this job wasn't near enough to pay the out-of-state tuition at Wisconsin. Fortunately, I had done well academically at Elgin Community College, and I received, among other things, a fee out-of-state fee remission scholarship to Wisconsin. This was supplemented at times with both a Vilas fellowship and a Knapp fellowship, both of which were scholarships, which in essence paid for my tuition and my room and board. I would continue during school breaks and semester breaks to work at the gas station in Illinois, which was only about 100 miles from Madison and near my home, to pick up spending money to help me in going through Wisconsin. During my senior year at Wisconsin, and I think the summer between my junior and senior years, which would have been the summer of 1970, I was also a work-study student and had a job at the Dictionary of American Regional English under the direction of Professor Frederick G. Cassidy. I worked there about 20 hours a week, initially logging in the research that was coming in from around the United States from field workers who were issuing surveys and making tapes of various regional dialects throughout the United States. It was fascinating. Professor Cassidy, of course, was a wonderful personality and a terrific man to work for, and the graduate students at the time who were working under him were also interesting individuals. I remember in particular a woman named Ann Hausman, who was the office manager for a while, and a graduate student in English studying for his PhD named Frank Siciliano. Professor Cassidy would later prove influential in my choice of a graduate school for English. He had received his PhD, I believe, from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and in time, that's where I would also attend graduate school. My first residence in Madison were the dorms. I lived in Og Hall West on the fourth floor. That was one of the new high-rise dorms in Madison. In all respects, it certainly was a zoo. There were two people to each small room, and of course the shower and bathroom facilities were communal. Each two floors of the dorm was organized into a residential unit, and ours was called Bar Hall, and it was there that I met most of the people who would remain close friends of mine throughout my days in Madison. During the late 60s and the early 70s, the Greek fraternity system had become highly unpopular, and I believe for good reason. The people who belonged to the fraternities did not, to my mind at least, seemed to be as politically sensitive to what was happening in the nation or on the campus as others. The Greek system was also discriminatory and represented, all in all, what I believe to be an outdated and outworn style of life. I was rushed by a couple of fraternities when I was in the dorm, but decided against joining any one of them, and for what I would deem to be political and social reasons. After living a year in Og Hall, I moved to Lakeside Street, which was on the other side of the bay, I believe Monona Bay, below campus, and I lived in a little four-apartment building on that street. I would drive to and from the campus, which wasn't very far. Later on, and including my senior year at Wisconsin, I lived at 642 State Street in some apartments, which were over storefronts. The storefront restaurant changed ownership or business quite frequently. At one time it was a hamburger place called Millard Fillmore's, and another time it was a taco restaurant. But this was an ideal place in which to live. The back door of the apartment opened up onto a parking lot, which opened up itself onto Langdon Street. And so I was just a few blocks from the Union and the Red Gym and the lakefront. And of course, a very short walk up State Street, either to go to the Capitol area in one direction or to Bascom Hall, where most of my classes in English were held, in the other direction. My landlords were a couple of older Swedish gentlemen, Ole Olsen, and I can't think of whose partner's name were, but they had an office in the building itself and played checkers most of the day when not receiving our rents. I think Jack Johnson was the other landlord. When I came to Wisconsin, I knew that I was going to major in English. Wisconsin had an incredibly traditional but excellent curriculum for liberal arts majors. I don't know if they have changed since the late 60s, but in order to receive a BA degree with a major in English, for example, a student would have to take 12 hours of the sciences, including a lab course in either physics or chemistry, as well as 14 hours of a foreign language and several hours of math, including 10 hours of calculus. The only way to avoid the calculus was to take extra credit hours in language, and that's what I did. I wound up taking, I believe, over 24 or 25 hours of French, as well as 8 hours of Italian, solely to avoid calculus. The worst class I took was a Chemistry 108 class. It was a 5-hour lab course in chemistry. Either that course or a physics laboratory course were required for the degree. Chemistry was probably the worst grade I received at Wisconsin, but I passed it with a C and survived. I was able to graduate with honors and to be inducted into Phi Kappa Phi Honorary Society, despite the chemistry. Most of my English classes at Wisconsin were large lectures, generally 3 hours of lecture each week, plus 1 hour with a teaching assistant in what was called a quiz section. We developed closer relationships with our teaching assistants than with our professors because of this system. And as a result, when the teaching assistants formed the TAA, a teaching assistants union in 1970 or so, there was great student support for the union and its strike. Ultimately, I don't believe that the large class sizes for lectures had any bearing on the quality of instruction that I received at the university, which to this day I deem as excellent, because of the ability to obtain more individualized instruction with the teaching assistants for each course. I enjoyed the language courses, particularly the upper level French courses, once I was able to study French literature and learn to write papers for these classes in French. I believe my favorite French professor was a man named Peter Schoeffer, who taught 19th century French literature. There were two English professors who had the greatest impact on my study. Both of them taught large lectures. One was Alvin Whitley, who taught Romantic poetry as well as Victorian and Edwardian literature. Professor Whitley always seemed nervous with the lecturing format, he would come into a large lecture hall in Bascom Hall, and he would pull the lectern as close to him as possible and have his back almost propped up against the blackboard on the wall. He would ask that there not be any questions until the end of the class or until he finished lecturing on a particular subject matter. But he was one of the greatest lecturers I have ever experienced in my studies. He addressed everything comprehensively and in a terrific voice, and I took two courses from him. The other professor who was phenomenal was Standish Henning, who I took for two 400 level semesters of Shakespeare. Standish Henning was one of the most brilliant lecturers that I have ever had. We spent 6 weeks on Hamlet alone, and to this day I can discuss with great particularity just about any individual line from that play. Both Professors Whitley and Henning influenced me into a love of literature and learning, which remains to this day. I should also mention two other professors of which I was quite fond. One was Philip Herring, who I took for a 500 level James Joyce seminar my senior year. We read all of Joyce, and his love of his subject matter was so obvious that it made it all the more special for us to learn Joyce. And I also took Professor Herring for a course in modern fiction. Another professor who was a tremendously creative thinker was Professor Joseph Wittrich, who taught a Milton course. Professor Wittrich would later leave Wisconsin, I believe, to go teach at an Eastern university. To this day, I think that the education I received at Wisconsin was superb. I'm a bit concerned over what I have perceived to be a drop-off in Wisconsin's reputation nationally. I think this was due in reaction to the student protest when the administration, by calculation, reduced the number of out-of-state students, particularly from Illinois and New York and New Jersey, who had traditionally sought to attend the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Attempting to rename the University of Wisconsin at Madison, so as to paradoxically make it appear to have been on a par with UWisconsin Whitewater or other institutions from the state system, was also a mistake, I believe, on behalf of the administration, for it had the effect, in the national eye at least, to water down the preeminence of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is the dominant and most reputable state institution in Wisconsin. With respect to student publications, I did read the Daily Cardinal religiously, and in fact, I subscribed to it for several years after I graduated from Wisconsin. The Daily Cardinal was one of the best student papers in the nation. Its point of view was, of course, aligned and sympathetic with the anti-war movement, but it enjoyed an excellent reputation on campus. I knew several of the reporters and photographers for the Cardinal, and it was clear that they were getting the kind of background that was going to make them terrifically competent news people wherever they went after graduation. On occasion, I would read the Capital Times, in order to get a more comprehensive perspective on what was going on in the world. But the Cardinal was incredibly good in keeping up not only what was going on the national political scene, but what was happening at the university. And this included not only politics, but sporting events involving the university. Classwork and study took up so much time that there was very little time left over for leisure. There were a number of places I remember with fondness. One was the Nitty Gritty, which was very close to the dorm where Og Hall was. And at some point in the evening or the early morning, the Nitty Gritty would stop serving hard liquor. And that would permit students who were under the age of 21 to come in and catch a musical set or two. In particular, Luther Allison, who was a bluesman from Chicago, used to come up and play the Nitty Gritty quite a bit. There was also a bar between the Capitol and the university itself, and I can't recall its name, Dino's or Gino's or something, that used to have live rock music weekend evenings. But the Nitty Gritty was really my favorite spot to go catch music, because you could study at the dorm until 11 or 12 o'clock and then go out and get a bite to eat and go over to the Nitty Gritty and stay until 2, 3, 4 in the morning. I once saw members of Jefferson Starship come jam with Luther Allison in the early evenings. Janis Joplin also had a concert on campus once, which I attended. Being on a student budget, there weren't many restaurants in Madison that students regularly would frequent, although there are a couple that I did go to a lot, mostly because the food was both good, plentiful, as well as being cheap. The one in particular that I recall was Gino's, which was on State Street. Gino's was a Italian restaurant, and you could get a plate of lasagna or meatballs there with a lot of sauce and all the Italian bread that you could eat with it. And it didn't cost all that much. The other restaurant that I liked was a place called Pisan's Portobello. There were two restaurants, but we always went to the basement restaurant, where they served about 80 different kinds of domestic and foreign beers. And I think every undergraduate at Wisconsin at one time had a beer bottle collection of all the various European beers that were sold at Pisan's Portobello. Other places where one would go to get a beer, at least, would be both the college keg and the village pub, although these places, by and large, were frequented by the fraternity and sorority people. I did spend a lot of time in the Memorial Union. The Rathskeller was one of my favorite places to go and get a bite to eat and just to talk and converse with other people about courses, literature, films. I loved the small theater that they had at the Union, and I think movies cost something like 78 cents there back in 1969, 1970, and I saw a lot of films at the Union Theater. The campus had a plethora of terrific film societies that would do Ingmar Bergman festivals, for example. And I would attend a lot of these, and that would be a frequent place to take a date. I didn't participate much in recreational sports, although I did play softball with the Og Hall intramural team when I was living in the dorm, and would participate in some pickup basketball games on occasion, sometimes in the old Red Gym. University of Wisconsin-Madison was different from a lot of campuses because beer could be consumed by 18-year-olds at the time. One of the first things everyone did upon arriving in Madison was to get a Dane County ID card, that would permit us to get into places like the college keg and the pub and to drink beer. Drugs were certainly prevalent on campus. We didn't see much of what would be considered hard drugs. Certainly, marijuana smoking was prevalent in the dorms, and I would assume even in the fraternity houses at that time. But it was the late 60s and early 70s, and that was also a time when there were a lot of psychedelic drugs, including LSD and mescaline, that were available on the campus. The sexual revolution had reached Madison at this time, and while sex certainly wasn't as narcissistic as it would become in the 80s, there certainly was a lot of opportunity on the campus to have sex with different partners in an era that well predated the AIDS epidemic. Except for the hockey team, the Wisconsin athletic teams were pretty bad during my time on campus. I did, even though I would have been deemed a student radical, go to Wisconsin football games. During my junior year, Wisconsin defeated Iowa, and the students marched on the Capitol building that evening. I think that broke a 17-game Wisconsin losing streak. We did see great football teams play at Camp Randall. I believe the Steve Owens led Oklahoma team played there in a non-conference game one fall, and of course we saw at least every other year the Michigan and Ohio State teams from the Big Ten in Camp Randall. I also saw an LSU team, I believe in the fall of 1969, play at Camp Randall. The basketball team did not fare much better, but the hockey team was always in contention for a conference title or a national championship. And interestingly, the student attendance at hockey matches generally was greater than at Big Ten basketball games. The student behavior during athletic events, with the exception of hockey, was pretty jaded because the Wisconsin teams were so unsuccessful. I remember during my junior year in particular, I believe the coach was a man named Cota or Quata or something like that. I think it was before the Jardine years, but Neil Graff was the quarterback. And during my time there, the two principal running backs were Alan A-Train Thompson and Rufus the Roadrunner or Ferguson. Rufus Ferguson was also a student in one of my fellow student in one of my freshman Italian classes, and he was a fascinating personality, bright, witty, and a tremendous athlete. But the student attitude towards athletics, except for the fraternity crowd, was very jaded. In fact, during the football games, we used to chant second to nine every time Wisconsin would get a first down, which was rare, because they would run Alan Thompson off tackle, and if lucky, they would pick up 1 yard, and it would be second and long. I continue to this day to follow Wisconsin sports, and I was quite happy to see the Badgers earn a berth in the Rose Bowl for January 1st, 1994. One of my principal reasons for going to Wisconsin was because of the campus's reputation as a liberal or radical bastion, I think dating back to the era when the Progressive Party and Bob La Follette emerged out of Wisconsin. As well, my high school history teacher, Bill Schmidt, used to say that students would go on strike or protest at Wisconsin even when the price of ice cream cones would go up at the dairy school. The political climate during my years on campus was fascinating, And I suppose, like anyone who was involved in the protest movement, have left a lasting impression upon me. I look back with a great bit of nostalgia, but incredible fondness and longing towards the 60s and my time at Wisconsin. I think Wordsworth expressed it best in the prelude when he was speaking about the French Revolution, when he wrote, "Bliss was it in that dawn to have been alive, when to be young was very heaven." And that is very much the way I look back at the 60s and being on the Wisconsin campus. My fellow students and I felt very much that we were at the forefront of what was happening nationally in the protest movement. In fact, there was a kind of campus pride that was generated in being from Wisconsin, because to be from Wisconsin was similar to being at a place like Berkeley or Columbia during the late 60s. To use a 60s cliche, it was where things were happening and where the political life was exciting and enervating. There were several leaders of the protest movement. I remember several of the individuals who were involved in Students for Democratic Society. In addition to those people, Jim Rowan and David Siff, both who were coming out of the English department, were instrumental in uncovering the kind of research that was being performed at the Army Math Research Center. I remember several open hearings and discussions being held well before the bombing of the Army Math Research Center, in which the nature of chemical and war-related research was being performed. My view towards that, and I think was the view of a lot of students at the time, was that a university was a place where a search for truth was to be undertaken. That universities represented the last refuge in a culture that had been decaying, to preserve the higher ideals of politics and humanity. And therefore it was anathema to me and many others on the campus that so close to those buildings such as Bascom Hall and Van Vleck, where the humanities were taught, would be this secret research center that was promoting the very system that we deem politically corrupt in the United States, that had sponsored and had continued to promote the war in Vietnam. And the idea of an Army Math Research Center on a university struck many of us as immoral. And we just did not understand why it continued to exist and why, once its true purposes, particularly the secrecy surrounding its projects, began to get revealed, that the campus administration took such drastic measures to silence dissent. The firing of David Siff from the Department of English was one example of that, when the virtue of academic freedom seemed to fall victim to national politics and partisan national politics. So I and a lot of my fellow students, I think, came to Wisconsin probably as political liberals and became radicalized by our time on campus. I participated in numerous rallies and marches, and there was a sense in all of them that we were doing something that was going to help change the direction of our culture and our nature. There were a few people who were oriented towards violence, and they were a very, very small minority amidst the protest movement. SDS in particular was very much nonviolent until some splinter groups, such as Revolutionary Youth Movement 2, would break off from it. Most marches and rallies were peaceful, albeit a few students would often begin to throw things at the various police forces. The National Guard, when it came to campus, we felt great sympathy towards, because we felt that by and large those in the National Guard were draft dodgers. The most hated folks on campus were the Dane County Riot Patrol, because they came into campus in this outlandish riot gear with bizarre helmets with shields in front of them, and they were generally from the rural areas of Wisconsin and seemed to be looking to pick fights with students during protests. But I can remember quite well the day in May 1970 when we learned about the killings at Kent State. My roommate, who had been a former high school football player and who had spent a year at the University of Missouri, and who was kind of a large, macho guy, came back to the room in the afternoon, and he had tears in his eyes, and I asked him what was going on, and he said that they're killing us now. And that very much was the feeling after Kent State, that the Nixon administration had resorted to outright violence against students. And the protest, curiously, at Wisconsin had escalated after Camp State and not after disclosure of the secret air war against Cambodia at the time. By 1970 and 1971, however, which was after the bombing of the Army Math Research Center, the spirit really seemed to go from protest. I think the bombing of the Army Math Research Center had that emotional effect on the student body, and that the feeling on campus towards the war was much different. Students were still opposed to the war, but the war was ostensibly winding down, and a lot of the idealism of the movement was lost. I was living on Lakeside Street during the evening, during the summer, when the Army Math Research Center was bombed. And I remember hearing percussion from the explosion in my apartment, and of course seeing the newspapers the next day. I was really saddened and remain saddened over the death of the young physicist, Robert Fasnacht. And there really is no excuse for that. Although at the time, I think a lot of students sensed that the timing of the bombing was such that there was an attempt to destroy property and not life. And that is, as I recall, the bombing was in the wee hours of the morning on a weekend. And I and most students never sensed that the killing of Robert Fasnacht was intended. On the other hand, the Army Math Research Center was such an anathema on campus that I could understand fully why individuals had sought to destroy it. And by saying that, I don't mean to condone the bombing, which I don't. I always remained nonviolent with respect to protest. But what I mean to say is that I understood the kind of frustration that led someone to go over the edge and to take such a drastic action. There were a number of campus personalities when I was on campus. I had a great deal of respect for President Harrington at the time. Especially in retrospect, always believed that he did a lot for the University of Wisconsin and helped make it a progressive university with a national reputation. And I was saddened when, in the wake of the student protests and particularly the Army math bombing, that he, in essence, was forced or compelled to resign. But I think that he was a man who had a lot of vision and heart. There were a number of campus characters, as you might imagine, in the 60s. There was a fellow named Snowball, an elderly black man with a white beard who washed windows around State Street, who everyone knew and liked. There was a man who sold, I think, the Capital Times at the street at the base of Bascom Hill, who a lot of us were familiar with. Professor Harvey Goldberg, of course, was an influential force on campus. I never took any of his courses, but like a lot of other students, I, to use the vernacular of the day, crashed them. He always gave his lecture, I think, on modern European history in the lecture hall at the Ag School in order to house the large number of students who would come to hear him lecture. When I went to Wisconsin, I knew that I was going to major in English. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. When I arrived at the university, I realized quickly that there was a difference between being an English major and an education major, and that paradoxically, one could be an English major and learn more about that particular field or discipline because of the nature and content of the courses taken than education majors would, yet would not be able to get licensed to teach high school English because of the lack of an education degree. In any event, I took a pure English degree, and I had several credit hours in French and Italian, mainly as a way of avoiding calculus. I was steered towards a graduate school in English when I left. In particular, Professor Cassidy from the Dictionary of American and Regional English encouraged me to apply to graduate school. And I applied to a number of them, including the University of Michigan. I was accepted to a number of graduate schools, and I accepted a position to enter the University of Michigan's English department as a master's degree candidate in the fall of 1972. I graduated with my bachelor's degree from Wisconsin in 1971. So, to correct that, I was accepted to go to Michigan for fall of 1971. I was still a candidate to be drafted, and although I applied for conscientious objector's status, I received a 1A draft status once my student deferment ended upon graduation from Wisconsin in 1971. I did not want to expend the money for graduate tuition and then be drafted or else face whatever action I was going to take in response to being drafted. So I returned to my home in Hampshire, Illinois, over to the other side of the tape. And resumed pumping gas at an all-night standard gas station where I worked full-time for a month or so during the summer, and then I got a job at a small factory in Hampshire called the Waxworks. The Waxworks was owned by a company in Chicago, Illinois, called, believe it or not, Hip Products Incorporated. Hip Products made scented candles, incense, and the kind of paraphernalia that were sold in head shops. I got a job making candles. And during the summer of 1971, I attended several rock festivals throughout the Midwest and realized that I just wasn't ready for graduate school. I wrote the University of Michigan and told the people in the Department of English that I would not be coming in the fall as scheduled. And I spent a year traveling around the United States making candles at the waxworks, where I rose from being a sawman, that is the person who cut the candles to size, to becoming a shift supervisor. By April of 1972, President Nixon reprieved all young men who had not yet been drafted. And I fell within that reprieve. At that time, I wrote the University of Michigan and asked if I could be admitted for the fall of 1972 based upon the application I had previously filed for fall of 1971. The English department wrote me back and admitted me to its master's program. And I moved to Ann Arbor in the late summer of 1972. I spent 5 years at the University of Michigan. I received my master's degree from the English department in 1973. I did quite well academically and did not receive any grade below an A minus during my master's year. And I was admitted to the English department's PhD program for the following year. I spent 4 years in the PhD program at the University of Michigan, where I specialized in 19th century British literature with a particular emphasis on the Romantic poets, undoubtedly a legacy of Professor Whitley's influence at Wisconsin. As well, I took a lot of Elizabethan literature courses, again, a legacy to Professor Henning at Wisconsin. I completed all my coursework for the PhD in, I think, 1976 and was awarded a Rackham pre-doctoral fellowship. During that year, I worked on my dissertation. And I also was the editor-in-chief of Rackham Literary Studies, which was a graduate student interdisciplinary graduate literary review. I accepted in fall of 1977 a teaching position in the English department at the University of New Orleans, in New Orleans, Louisiana. With my wife, Natalie Walker, who I had met in the master's program in English at Michigan, we moved to New Orleans in August 1977. I taught English at the University of New Orleans for 5 years. During that 5 years, my wife went to law school at Tulane University here in New Orleans. She did well, was a member of the law review, served as a federal judicial clerk, and obtained an attorney's job with a prestigious firm in New Orleans, largely because of what I learned from her going to law school. I decided to attend law school myself, and I entered Tulane University School of Law in the fall of 1982. The very fact that I went to law school was quite ironic, because the one thing I remember about law students at Wisconsin in the late 60s was, one, they seemed to be out of sync with the times. They appeared to be very conservative. Every time we walked by the law school, which was on one of the sidewalks ascending Bascom Hill, The law students always leered at women and just did not seem to be sensitive to what was going on politically at the time. As well, during the Wisconsin football games, I remember seeing the law students with derbies on their heads throwing canes over the goalpost at the time. And again, this seemed to be a throwback to an era that no longer existed on the campus or in the nation, for that matter. At any rate, I started Tulane Law School in 1982. I did well. I finished number six in my class. I was one of the editors on the Tulane Law Review. I received a judicial clerkship with a federal district judge here in New Orleans on the Eastern District of Louisiana District Court. And after that service, I joined the law firm of Gainsburg, Benjamin, Fallon, DeVete, and Ates. My practice involves principally trial work. I am a trial lawyer. I represent injured people, and by injured people, that would be people injured as a result of the negligence or fault of others who are physically injured. But I also do some civil rights work where I represent individuals who have been the victims of racial, sexual, age, or handicap discrimination. I became a partner with my law firm effective January 1st, 1990. And beginning January 1st, 1994, I will begin service on the firm's executive committee, which is a committee which manages the law firm. I have now lived in New Orleans for over 17 years. Both of my sons, who were born here, undoubtedly consider themselves New Orleanians, but my wife and I still very much consider ourselves Midwesterners. My sons, who are now 8.5 and 5.5, are being brainwashed, I suppose, to go to college eventually at either Wisconsin or Michigan. We would like both of them to be able to attend those, either one of those institutions. My sons do have Wisconsin t-shirts and sweatshirts, and know the lyrics to both On Wisconsin and Hail to the Victors, the Michigan fight song. I am a member of the Wisconsin Alumni Association and do enjoy getting the quarterly magazine in an effort to try to keep up with some campus news. There is a loosely organized alumni organization for Wisconsin graduates in the New Orleans area. On occasion in the fall, there is a get-together of Wisconsin graduates. And the Brat House in Madison ships down some brats and sauerkraut and beans, and they're cooked up on a grill. And I've been able to meet a number of individuals in this area who attended or graduated from Wisconsin, including a woman, Virgene Biggers, who is a court reporter. Who I frequently see during depositions that I attend in my practice. I look back at my days at Wisconsin and ultimately Michigan too with great fondness. I think I came of age there, and even the fact that I practice the kind of law that I practice, I think is attributable to coming of age at Wisconsin. I still see myself as a battler for the little guy, the injured person, or the worker against the large corporation or business. I feel a great deal of pride at having attended Wisconsin and having graduated from there, particularly during the time when I was able to be there. As I said before, it was an exciting time, and although it was a time that was certainly marked by sadness and anger and tragedy, such as the bombing of the Army Math Research Center, it was nonetheless an era that I think helped mold me into a better human being. I would hope that the university, in any kind of reaction to the protest movement of the 60s, will continue to keep a national focus and endeavor to become more than just a state university, but to continue to be a great national university, ranking as one of the premier public institutions with the UCalifornia, Berkeley, and University of Michigan campuses in that respect. I hope that this tape has helped to respond to some of the queries that you asked about with respect to the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. If I can be of more assistance, I would certainly hope that you would contact me again. Please accept my best wishes for your project. Goodbye.